Hey, psst, it's me. You know, that voice. No, not the voice. My voice. The voice of the language show and sometimes why. I could tell you my name, but I know I don't need to because my voice is so distinct, unique, and recognizable. It's basically like a fingerprint. Right? Today on the program, the case of the vocal fingerprint and whether we all possess a unique voice.
With voice biometrics, we're measuring the physical characteristics of the way you speak.
But what if that so-called vocal fingerprint isn't foolproof?
You could take on the voice of a national leader or the head of the armed forces, and you have a sort of scenario of vocal terrorism.
And beyond the voice, there are ways we choose our words, use certain expressions that forensic linguists can spot and link us to crime scenes.
The numbers of the suicide note were significantly different from the numbers of the deceased man.
Today, an in-depth investigation of the linguistic fingerprint. I'm Jane Farrow, and this is And Sometimes Why.
This is the Agent Voice Verification Service. To confirm your identity, please say your officer ID number after the tone.
863974.
Verification successful. After the tone, please continue with your call.
It's called voice biometric technology. The idea behind it's pretty straightforward. We all speak and sound differently. And biometric technology has progressed to the point that our voices can be used as passwords, say when we're doing banking over the phone. Just last year, Bell Canada started collecting customers' voice samples to use as security passes. One company developing voice print technology is Diaphonics. It's based in Halifax.
Everyone's voice is quite unique. There really is nobody else in the world that would have exactly the same voice model as you.
Jeremy Bernard is the Diaphonics Vice President of Marketing and Business Development.
With fingerprint measuring, you're measuring a physical characteristic of an individual. And in effect, with voice biometrics, we're doing the same thing. We're measuring the physical characteristics of the way you speak, such as your pitch, intonation, essentially measuring characteristics of your vocal tract. So that's a physical measurement of an individual's voice. But we're also adding in some behavioral characteristics, like how long it takes you to say certain words, certain phrases, and even your pitch and intonation on specific syllables.
So tell me how secure the voice model fingerprint is.
In a typical live, real-world deployment, what we would see would be something like 99% accuracy. Approximately 1% of callers would either have to go through the system again and provide another voice sample or be pushed off to a live operator.
So when you look into the crystal ball there in the future of voice-activated security, what do you see?
You may recall when Martha Stewart was incarcerated at home that she was required to wear an ankle bracelet.
Yes.
We've come up with what we believe is a better solution to that, and that involves our system placing a call to the individual's home, and when they answer the phone, we verify their identity with our voice biometrics and create a recording of that. So the law enforcement agency will know not only was the phone answered at the home, but it was answered by the correct person, and that they have a record of that. It's an application that, you know, didn't really cross our minds, but we were kind of brought into it by law enforcement agencies.
Okay, so voice prints are secure enough to be used to keep tabs on people under house arrest. Sounds good. But according to David Howard, voice prints will soon be vulnerable to security breaches. He warns that within a decade or so, computer technology will be able to replicate human voices perfectly. David Howard is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of York in England.
Hello there.
Before we skip ahead to the future, David, I was wondering if you could tell me how good computers are right now at replicating the human voice.
If you listen to a computer now that's speaking to you, you almost always know it's a computer. It's very rare that you would mistake a computer as being a human being. And that's because we've been looking in research at making them intelligible, so you understand what they're saying. And we haven't yet sorted out how to make them sound like human beings. That's the big step.
So what kinds of things are missing from that computer voice that would make it sound human?
Well, some people say the problem is actually it's too good. There are imperfections in our voices, you know, bits of saliva going down the throat, just change the way the vibrations happen.
Stuttering, hesitation.
That's right. And we don't do that with the computer. We try and make it really good so that we can really hear the message. And our brains know that that's not really a human at the other end.
So how are you going to change this with your technology? How are you going to simulate the human voice more accurately?
Well, the key thing to simulating a particular person is to know something about the tubes that make up their vocal system. So we have the vibrations in the larynx, the vocal folds vibrate, mm-hmm. and above that the sound comes through the mouth and sometimes the nose, and that's the sound that you're hearing now as I speak to you.
Okay.
And the tube I have is very particular to David Howard. It is my tube. Mm. So another man of the same age from the same area won't sound exactly the same. So the key is in the detailed changes inside my tube. And that's what we're getting at. And that's how we're beginning to do synthesis, by actually modelling these tubes in the computer and making them speak.
And like pushing the sound through it to simulate
that's-
that?
That's exactly right. We've got this simulated tube and we put a sound through it that's just like a human larynx sound. And at the other end, we've got what we call a virtual microphone. We've got a place where we can tap that sound off and then play it back. And what you hear is a sound that is much more human.
Wow. What are the implications of this if a computer can perfectly replicate a human voice?
Right. Well, the key first thing to note is that we've got some way to go before we can make these things produce speech. At the moment, they're producing vowels. And the key thing is they can produce diphthongs. They can make the changing vowels, diphthongs like I and ear, where the vocal tract moves. And from an engineering point of view, that has been one of the most crucial things to get sorted out before we can think about the full speech, the full gamut of speech. But if we do roll ahead 10, 15 years, when I believe we'll have had the time to get these things sorted out, and we're in a position where anybody could synthesize anybody else saying any message, then one possibility is that if you were unfortunate enough to lose your larynx through larynx cancer, so they had to take your larynx out, you could actually be given your original voice back. So instead of using an electronic buzzing device, you would get your own voice back and you could be the real you. So there's a lot of positive, but of course, to every positive, there's always a negative. This kind of technology in the wrong hands could, for example, mean that I could synthesize your bank manager ringing you up to get your bank details, or your loved one ringing you up either to play a joke or to ask you things that you would only tell that person.
So,
or at a much bigger level, you perhaps could imagine that you could take on the voice of a national leader or the head of the armed forces, take over a communications channel, and then could be broadcasting somebody, a leader, saying what you want them to say, and you have a sort of scenario of vocal terrorism.
Well, it's sort of like really old school James Bond.
It is really, yes,
Dr.
that's
Evil,
right.
Really, like, you feel that this vocal ID stuff could really go in that direction?
I believe it could, yes, because the key to it is this business of dealing with the tubes, the models of the vocal tract. Synthesis at the moment doesn't use tubes, it uses an acoustic model that was generated back in the 1950s, which has served us extremely well and means we can produce this highly intelligible speech.
Hmm.
But what it doesn't do is allow us to model what in engineering terms we call the second order effects, what's actually really happening to a rather lower level, but so important to our ears to have that information in order for them to believe it's from a human.
Well, thank you very much, David. Very interesting talking to you.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Well, take care. Bye-bye.
And bye-bye to you too.
David Howard is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of York in England. So our voice fingerprint might be replicable, but that's just the sound of our voice. Maybe the key to our vocal uniqueness isn't in how we sound, but in what we say. To wit, the idiolect, our own individual way of speaking. The idiolect is all about our choice of words, cadence, register, our idiosyncratic way of expressing our thoughts and feelings. We all do it without thinking, but if you're a writer, you have to create distinct voices from scratch for yourself and your characters. Lorna Jackson is an author and writing instructor at the University of Victoria. Her most recent book is Cold Cocked, on hockey. She lives in Machozen on Vancouver Island. Lorna, if you're creating a character and you need them to have a believable, authentic voice, what sorts of details in their background might you make up for them?
You're looking at things like where they come from, age, attitude, personal history, history of the place they're from, among other things. And that's going to influence the sound of a character and how they engage in conversation.
Well, let's say we have a guy from where you live, in Machozen, British Columbia. Let's call
okay.
him Gus. Tell me what sorts of influences there may be on Gus and how he talks.
Okay, well, coming from Machozen, sort of 5,000 people, rural southern Vancouver Island, you're not going to want to get just what his vocabulary is, and you want that specific and accurate, but I'd make sure I understood all the influences. So my characters, let's say he's 18 and living here to attend, the new hockey academy at the high school. Mm. And Machozin has a corner store. The sign says Machozin Country Store. And then once we knew the owner better, we called it Chuck's. It was sold a couple of years ago, and it became Tony Coe's. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a nod to Timmy Hoes, and that sacrilegious sort of shorthand that students use for Tim Hortons. Anyway, so my character, I let's call him Colby instead. This is a hockey player, after all, and Gus doesn't quite make it. Colby would likely refer to the store as Tony Coe's. And so Colby's going to have a black and tan dachshund, maybe named Olaf. And he speaks sometimes to that dachshund in German profanity that he learned from another goalie in Medicine Hat or something. Or maybe the goalie's hot sister is where he learned the profanity. So that's the kind of thing that we'd be looking at.
So, Lorna, what kinds of questions would you ask in trying to sort of determine what way one character, in this case Colby, was going to talk? What else would you ask of him if you were in a conversation?
I'd probably ask him, Colby doesn't want to talk about stuff anyway, but
he's a teenage male.
He is, and a hockey player at that. He's pretty silent. And
that's so, the ultimate challenge in creating that character.
But that doesn't mean I'm off the hook. I do need to know who his parents are, whether his parents, if they're living in Machozin, are they part of the horsey set with that kind of vestigial British accent, or is he? Does he come from a long line of Norwegian old-timers in Machozin, and is there still some of the Norwegian accent there? Mm. How did he feel about his parents? What were his parents doing when he was first born? What are they all about? And that German goalie in Medicine Hat, what was the relationship there? You know, is he listening to Queen of the Stone Age, or is he listening to Jeff Buckley, or what?
And this is all going to affect how he speaks.
It is, and it's actually just kind of the homework you need to do on a character so that sometimes you come up with the vocabulary and diction that you didn't even know was there because you start to research a little bit. You know, if he is listening to Queen of the Stone Age, I want to listen to that music too and see if I can take some of that talk out and use it for the character.
So this is a very conscious process for you.
Yeah, it is. I think it is for most writers, especially if you're writing a character like Colby who is nothing like me. I can't use characters who are all like me because it's really not that interesting. And so if I'm writing someone who is so vastly different, I need to know more about him.
And you're a writer that's writing in a teenage male voice. Like, what is it that you do as a writer that allows you to do that sort of almost schizophrenic task?
I think it's naturally what writers do. I think my voice, my writer voice, which is different than what a character's voice is, right? It's more to do with style and kind of that recognizable thumbprint of a writer's voice. I think my voice is made up of a whole bunch of other things that delight me, voices that delight me. For example, in Cold Cocked, in the book on hockey, I was consciously going for a combination of Lucinda Williams and her sort of barbed wire and concrete and grit and relentless kind of sadness, and mixing that with Mary Tyler Moore's optimism and the dimpled sort of optimism that turning the world on with her smile. And I was definitely trying to do that and still make it my style. And I know with a comic voice, and there is a comic voice in that book too, I know I steal that from a guy I lived with 30 years ago who was a Lithuanian bass player from Wawa, Ontario. You know, you're being a magpie with voice and making it into your own.
Thanks very much for talking today, Lorna.
Thank you.
So there are many factors influencing our choice of words, whether they're spoken or written. The combination of these influences is unique. Nobody has exactly the same life story, the same identity. Maybe this adds up to the elusive linguistic fingerprint. That idea got a boost from the case of Ted Kaczynski, otherwise known as the Unabomber. More than a decade ago, the FBI hired linguists to pore over a manifesto that the Unabomber insisted be published in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Prosecutors used this analysis to argue that Ted Kaczynski was indeed the manifesto's author. It was all based on a tip from the Unabomber's brother, David, who'd read the document and thought he recognized Ted's idiosyncratic writing style.
It's not surprising that someone who knows you very well will recognize the voice in some written material, in the same way that someone who knows you very well recognizes your spoken voice when you pick up the phone or hear someone over a radio program even.
Carol Chasky is a forensic linguist, a gumshoe with a linguistics degree. She runs the Institute for Linguistic Evidence in Georgetown, Delaware. She says the Unabomber case is the most famous but not the most accurate example of how forensic linguistics really works.
The approach that was taken to the Unabomber manifesto was based on what's called forensic stylistics. My theory differs from forensic stylistics in that I don't think we can point at one or two characteristics and say, oh, look, this person uses ampersands or this person uses a particular word. I do not believe that those characteristics are reliable indicators of individuality in language. The work I do is based on linguistics and the computational or computer analysis of language.
So can you describe a scenario in which you might be called in to help with a case and how you would do that?
Yes. One of my first cases was a case in which a suicide note was left on a home computer. And the question arose as to whether the deceased person had actually written his own suicide note, since it was never signed and never printed out, or whether someone else in the apartment might have written the suicide note. The detective was able to give me a lot of writing from the deceased man, as well as his roommates, and I was able to analyze the documents statistically and then show that there was very, very little chance that the document belonged to the deceased.
Wow. So it might have been a murder then.
In fact, it was a murder, and one of the roommates was convicted of the murder of the deceased person.
Wow. How did you work that out? How did you determine that this guy's writing who died was different from, it seems, the writing that appeared on the computer?
I counted all the nouns, all the verbs, all the adjectives, all the adverbs, prepositions, determiners, and how they were attached to the words around them. And then when I get those numerical counts, I'm able to run statistics. And in that suicide case, I was able to show that the numbers of the suicide note were significantly different from the numbers of the deceased man, but they were not significantly different from one of the roommates. That's what really allowed the police to go ahead and arrest him as a defendant in the case.
Well, Carol, it sounds like a linguistic fingerprint. I mean, is this not an idiolect?
Well, the initial introduction of the term idiolect in linguistics had to do with the voice. And over the years, people have tried to see, is it also related to other modes of language production, such as writing? What's interesting about the concept is that there's really never been any empirical proof that an idiolect really does exist.
Hmm.
My work in written language at least is getting us to the point where we can say that we can distinguish people who are different from each other with a fairly high degree of accuracy, about 95%. But I don't go so far personally as saying that there is an idiolect or a linguistic fingerprint, because I don't really know how we could prove that scientifically.
So why do you think people make such a big deal about this idea of finding the linguistic fingerprint?
Well, I think it's a very trendy idea. I think it's a very naive idea. And I think it's linguistically not very sophisticated in terms of not understanding how language really works. Nonetheless, I think that people are engaged by the idea because we all like the idea that we're unique.
Different.
Yes. What I find most interesting about the work I've been doing over the last 15 years is that what really makes us different is based on what we all share. That's what's so beautiful about it. Language is an extremely forgiving system. And when I say it's forgiving, I mean that we're able to help each other along because we share these grammars that we each have so that I can complete sentences for someone, or I can understand what they really mean when they're not quite saying it. And all of that comes about because we have this huge shared grammar of syntactic and semantic patterns, which we each get to favor or disfavor. And I really believe that our individuality, as much as it is expressed in language, is expressed by the proportionality or the habitual uses with which we favor some patterns and don't favor others. And that's something that we can actually count and then we can test statistically.
It's been really interesting talking to you, Carol. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Even if there's no scientific test for uniqueness in a person's language, that doesn't mean we don't all have a few quirks. And here at Sometimes Why, for instance, one of those quirks is called Tom Howell, the word nerd. And he's with me right now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jane. Oh, by the way, when I say hi, I don't actually mean hi, H-I. I'm actually saying hi, H-Y-E, which is a unique greeting that only I say and which separates me from the rest of the human race.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
H-Y-E.
Yeah, it's what I get when I type an email and I'm trying to type hey at the beginning of the email, H-E-Y, but sometimes it comes out H-Y-E, which would be pronounced hi. So now I've adopted it as kind of a combination of hey and hi that only I say, and most people don't even notice.
You're very special. I admit I haven't noticed myself, though. I'm sorry about that.
No, you probably thought I was just saying hi, H-I.
You know, that's completely obscure, all right?
Yep.
But I have a friend who does have a distinct way of speaking. Her name is Inga Weffers. Now, she grew up in Germany, so when she came to Canada, she had to learn English. So some of the ways that she uses expressions and vocabulary have to do with the fact that she's just has adopted this language. The amazing thing about it is that she takes an expression and just shifts it by even a syllable or a word and actually can often improve on the original meaning of the saying. Here's an example.
Grab the bull by the balls. You know, just jump in. And I knew that you had to grab the bull somewhere, and the first thing which came to my mind was the balls on the bull instead of the horns.
That's very idiosyncratic, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
People have been sending us their vocabularial idiosyncrasies recently, and I thought we could play a couple of those clips. Here's one.
It's Charles Sherratt calling from St. John, New Brunswick. When I was a teenager, I was surrounded by a lot of people who are much older than I was, growing up with my grandparents and whatnot, and they used a lot of words that I didn't hear anyone else say, like dungaree for blue jeans and runners for sneakers. And I liked them, so I sort of took up using them. And now I haven't adopted a new word in a while, but I still get looked at oddly for calling dungarees and runners and soda for soda pop and things like that.
And if you think that's weird, here is an even weirder expression from Kaylee in Fredericton.
My family has a couple, but I think the most interesting one is E, which apparently originates when my uncle was learning how to speak about 45 years ago. And E was his way of saying, I found it. So that migrated to the other generations of the family, and now the three living generations all say E.
When they found it.
When they mean I found it, they say E, which it means that in that family, E, you could say, in fact, now you realize why I chose that clip in particular, E is in that family's E-collect. And E-collect is the variety of language spoken by a family.
A family dialect.
A family dialect. People have invented lots of words that end in lect to give them something to study. And obviously, the lects that are spoken by larger groups are easier to tell apart. So it's very hard to tell apart two people's idiolects. And it's pretty hard to tell two families' ecolects apart unless they're from different big groups. Like maybe they speak different sociolects.
I suppose social groups. That would be sociolect, huh?
Yeah, the language spoken by different sort of social classes or whatever. And big regions, of course, have very different dialects. And when two of those dialects get really different and unique, they are called...
Languages.
Yes.
Oh, 50 points. Thank you. Okay, so because language is about the way groups talk, within the group, it's not surprising that an idiolect or one single person's language is a kind of fuzzy notion.
Yes, unless you include the idea that there's a group of people talking inside one's head, which sometimes I find there is. I don't know, maybe you don't. It's still kind of a useful word. I like to be able to say that, you know, in my idiolect, I like to use the word idiolect, partly just for the thrill of saying it, and because I think it sounds like it should mean the language spoken by idiots.
An idiolect full of sound and fury, perhaps, signifying...
Something fuzzy.
Yes. Thank you, Tom.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So I'm not so unusual after all. I've got a voice that sounds different, but could probably be replicated. And my quirky way of speaking might link me to a crime scene, but doesn't constitute a pure idiolect. But maybe there's something better than being unique. What makes us truly human is our ability to find common ground, to smooth out the social distances between us by mirroring each other through language. We start by saying sir and madam, but we have a tendency to downshift to buddy as soon as we're able. In the course of the day, we change how we speak dozens of times, according to the context and relationships we're negotiating. We do this because it makes us feel more comfortable. It helps us connect, and it's all done through subtle social cues embedded in our word choices and inflection. Next week on the program, we give you the silent treatment. That's right, we explore those deeply meaningful gaps between the words we say. Don't you be quiet. Call us with your thoughts on the meaning of silence at 1-866-531-WORD. That's 1-866-531-9673. And you can find out more about our show on our website at cbc.ca/andsometimeswhy. And Sometimes Why is produced by the strong silent type herself, Nicola Lukšić. Tom Howell, never at a loss for words, is our associate producer and word nerd. Mixmaster Dan Meissner is that quiet guy with the earphones on, and Tim Larmer gets paid to make us all sound good in studio. I'm Jane Farrell. See you next week.